That there are issues with privacy in the digital environment is not a new thing, right? We all recognize that, particularly with the advent of cell phones and video and social media collecting information and people publishing information all the time. In his new book, Privacy in the New Media Age, John L. Mills discusses an aspect of privacy in the digital environment that is extremely important, and that is the conflict between freedom of expression and privacy in this environment. And he is our guest on the show today. This is New Books in Technology. I am your host, Jasmine McNeely. So the book is Privacy in the New Media Age. And one of the first things we like to do on New Books in Technology is to always have the author give us some background on themselves. So tell us a little bit about John Mills, your background, education, your former lives.
Former lives. Well, I at one time was in politics. I was Speaker of the House in Florida, and I've been an academic. I was dean of the University of Florida College of Law, and I've been a lawyer. I've been involved in litigation with the firm Boies Schiller and Flexner, and have done a broad spectrum of things, including constitutional issues dealing with the First Amendment reapportionment, and well, some of the issues that got me interested in doing this book, Privacy Related to the Media, representing individuals like Don Branshaw, the SeaWorld trainer who died a couple of years ago in an accident with a killer whale, and trying to keep the personal information and videos about her from being broadcast through the new media and everywhere.
Tell us about that. So you've not just been an attorney for the SeaWorld case, but also a couple of other pretty high profile cases that dealt with the conflict between what your book is talking about, and that is the conflict between privacy and the press, right?
Right. The conflict is really pretty profound. We in the United States care a lot about access to information, and in the new world, there's a big demand for information. The case that first got me involved in this kind of thing was the murders of students in Florida back in 1990. The Danny Rolling case. He killed six students, brutally killed six students. The issue was the photographs of those crime scenes and the autopsies, which were awful. And I represented the families of those children who were killed, and remember vividly talking with them about their personal tragedy and their personal hurt during that period of time, and we were trying to prevent those pictures from being broadcast everywhere by some of the fringe media, and that's long before the internet would have broadcast that on a basis that they would today. And the judge did end up doing, I think, the right thing by saying that privacy and the harm from that disclosure outweighed the need of everyone to know about that. That case did give rise to another case, which is probably even better known generally, was the death of Dale Earnhardt at Daytona. And his family did not want that general disclosure of his autopsy photographs. And that was a case that was covered, well, worldwide and certainly in the United States intensely. And at that point, the internet was an issue and there was new media. And in fact, there were some websites involved in that case
right.
that clearly would have posted autopsy photos. And the judge there did the right thing as well and said that there was adequate information about causes of death and the accident in a written form as opposed to putting that photo on the internet for his wife and child and family to see.
Mm-hmm. So, why the book now, Privacy in the New Media Age? What prompted this?
Well, all of that background and then perhaps a more recent case with Don Bradshaw at SeaWorld, but also the new context, the fact that there are bloggers everywhere, and there seems to be a dangerous tendency for media to write first and think later.
Mm-hmm.
And the disclosure of inaccuracies, even a couple of years ago, the example of Shirley Sherrod, who was a Department of Agriculture official accused of racist comments by a website. The website was totally manufactured in terms of that issue, but it was covered by mainstream media. And that's one of the problems, that mainstream media will cover these types of inaccuracies because of speed. They don't want to be the last unit to broadcast it. And so that kind of thing, and the Shirley Sherrod story was false, but she was within 24 hours fired from a job, accused of being a racist, and by the end of 24 hours, everybody apologized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the danger, that there are some of those inaccuracies are not caught and are not as visible, and people don't apologize, and the media can people can be hurt.
And as part of a running theme or a mantra almost in the book, you state, or you have, is privacy and dignity matter. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that whole idea that privacy and dignity matter, even particularly within the context of a news media, and not just a news media, but various kinds of media that put out disinformation all the time.
Privacy and dignity matter. People have a tough time, and I have a tough time defining privacy.
Right.
And I think a way that we can all think about that for ourselves is, if we think about issues, the worst lies that have been told about us, or perhaps in a different light, the most sensitive truths that could be told about us, that we protect, and it's part of our dignity. And part of our dignity is to be able to think and to be able to exist in a society and a community, making our own decisions about information and our own identity. Now, these are impositions of third parties and other people on an individual's definition of themselves and on dignity, and we see that, whether it's hate mail, revenge porn, all sorts of disclosures and use of new technology that impose on the individual identity. And I think if you go back to even the basis of a lot of free speech concepts under the First Amendment, the First Amendment was also about individuals' right not to speak, and the freedom of identity and the freedom to think and the freedom to express yourself as you wish to express yourself. And so in many ways, this sort of intrusive society is actually contradictory to the First Amendment free individual principles. So I think it's you're right that the privacy dignity issue are completely connected and very hard in this current context.
So it seems like the lack of definitions or the very vague multiple definitions of privacy affect the conflict with free expression. And also, not just that, but the cultural differences. So in the book, you talk about the U.S., but you talk about the EU and how, you know, the countries of the EU have developed a very different idea about what privacy is and the importance of privacy, and also the importance of freedom of expression in comparison to the United States.
The EU and people in the EU have perhaps experienced more intrusive governments in the past than a lot of people in the United States. Nazi Germany is an obvious example where neighbors were informing on neighbors and family members on family members, and there was an oppressive mood and the desire to know everything about everyone by government. And therefore, dignity and individuality seem to permeate some of the policy making in the EU, and they will weigh dignity and privacy on basically an equal scale with publicity and newsworthy disclosure. So they will say, well, if that disclosure about an individual, the fact that a particular well-known individual was visiting a drug clinic, they may determine that that wasn't newsworthy. Mm-hmm. Where in the United States, we do bend over backwards to say everything is publicly available and newsworthy. So it's the question, and difficult question, is can you reach a balance? And it appears in many ways the EU has toiled with it more, where it seems in the United States we've said we presume that most everything is public.
So it seems like there's a fundamental conflict also within this conflict of what is news. So there's information, there's a whole lot of data, a whole lot of information that's published or available, but not all of that is actually news, right?
Well, and that's a great question, because we do believe in confidentiality for certain things like medical records, educational records, financial records. So we do think that not all information is newsworthy. But we really have a problem once a news organization obtains information to do what we would call prior restraint. And that is, once a news, for what purpose can we keep a newspaper from publishing something they know? And so even names of rape victims, which was a United States Supreme Court case, since the news media had obtained that lawfully, even if it was by accident,
right,
they were allowed to publish it with impunity, even though culturally and actually as a matter of law, we frequently said, we don't want that to happen. We think that's intrusive. We think it's unnecessary. We think it's not newsworthy. So we still struggle on the edges of this because there are lots of cases where mainstream media don't publish the name of an individual or a victim or someone involved in a crime, and bloggers do. And when it comes down to an actual test of were they legally authorized to do that, courts will usually say they were. and the mainstream media will say, well, we believe they were, but we exercise discretion, and therefore, you don't have to worry about it. But that's the world is new in a sense that the mainstream media doesn't control everything that's newsworthy at all.
Right. So, is there, is the larger, or one of the larger issues, the fact that there is kind of no definition of who is news media anymore?
That's a significant issue because historically, as we talked about in the book, that press and news media were much narrower, more defined. Not everybody had a printing press. Didn't have a printing press before the printing press was invented.
Right.
And so therefore, there was word of mouth, and then there were presses, and we evolved into broadcast media who are regulated, and then the internet, of course, which is unregulated in most senses, and it changed. So media ethics and ethics that are taught to people in journalism school are not part of the ethical structure of all bloggers.
Right. So, the book, Privacy in the New Media Age, you talk a lot about perhaps the role of law in this conflict between privacy and news, news media. In your opinion, what should be the role of law in this conflict?
Well, law actually needs to step up. In many ways, law is so far behind technology, which it usually is anyway, that it doesn't afford injured people a chance to be helped. And if an intrusion occurs, you should have a way to remedy that. And the courts need to return to a concept where intrusion upon privacy, whether that's a picture taken over a fence or a wiretap or an unauthorized recording, that's an intrusion, that's a tort, that's something that the individual whose privacy has been violated should have a right to recover, damages and the disclosure of private facts. It is possible for the law to do that. And as I mentioned here, in the new media age, in Europe and in other jurisdictions, some places that's worked. Now, I totally understand that newsworthiness is still a predominant concept, but there are limits. And for something that is completely personal, not newsworthy, individuals should have an ability to use the law to remedy that.
Does law, I mean, law is really rather normative. Does law really remedy things in this new media age? What I mean by that is, so a newspaper, a regular print newspaper, would have printed something that invaded someone's privacy in some way, and that was just one printing, and perhaps, you know, it was archived somewhere, but most people didn't dig through the archives to look for that specific newspaper, whereas the internet and social media, something is printed, and not printed, but published, and it's there almost into perpetuity. Now, if we go through the legal process, we can get, I guess, monetary remedies, but the information is still very much out there.
So, which is,
yeah, go ahead.
Which is a great point. There's, in Europe, they've even articulated this concept of the right to be forgotten.
Right.
And we've talked about it here some, and as you point out, in the technology age, that's really a myth that you can't expunge the world. And if something has been broadcast, it's on record somewhere. Someone has probably republished it. So what you can get is, yes, you can get monetary damages, you can get retractions, and you can get some things taken down from being readily accessible. So there are remedies where people have taken things off of major search engines, but so while it may be there, it's not something that's going to be found unless someone digs into an archive or looks very hard for something. And that's used to be de facto. You couldn't find things because they were so obscure. So you had obscurity, no file cabinets. Doesn't exist, and as you said, now it's searchable, it's findable. There are databases, and there are businesses that are in the business of finding and searching those databases.
Right. One of the ideas that you put forth in the book is the media privacy matrix.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could, you know, explain that to the to your audience.
Well, it's a way of determining what kind of legal options you may have based on circumstances and in any particular circumstance. So there are a series of basically logical questions you would ask. Where did the intrusion occur? I mean, was it in, did someone wiretap me in my home? And that means you were in a location which is inherently private and the law protects. Did someone take a picture of me at the bus stop? That's inherently public and not so protectable. Well, there's a larger picture of where it occurred. Did it occur in the United States or did it occur in Europe? And, of course, that seems like an easy question, but it's not as easy when you inject the internet, and if someone has made statements about you from some place in Europe, but has published it in a place that's normally read in your state or nationally, then you're crossing borders, and you have to answer that question. There are a series of other questions that go through in this matrix, and that is, who owns the information? Is it actually privately owned? Therefore, a person, if you own photographs, you don't have to give them to somebody unless there's a legal requirement. But if the media owns those same photographs, they can do with them what they want. How is the information obtained? Is it obtained legally or illegally? That is, if you wiretap somebody, that's illegal. That's an intrusion. The character of the information. Generally, if you're disclosing something that's true, it's going to be protected. And if it's false or defamatory, that's a different issue. And it's an opinion. If someone has an opinion, if somebody is a bad person or a crook, there may be a difference if they express it as an opinion or if they assert it as a fact. And so it's complicated. And even down to the fact that certain information in certain media is considered not intrusive. And the example I give was the Earnhardt case, where the written description of the autopsy was made public. Mm-hmm. But the actual autopsy photographs were not. because one medium is clearly more intrusive than the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, we've been looking at, I guess, this conflict from the perspective of the individual, I think. But what about from the perspective of the media or the media organization, the news organization? One of the things you talk about is that risk is now an inherent element of communications or news now. I guess the risk that you'll, invade someone's privacy and then get sued, right?
Yes, and so it's interesting, of course, that media, mainstream media, have always had the attorney, the First Amendment attorney that reviews things and counsels them that if they're on the edge of doing something which could generate litigation if it's defamatory and so forth. And one of the phenomena of the new media is that the individual in the basement with a computer and a website doesn't have that kind of filter.
Right.
And so what we're getting is the New York Times may well not write something, but an individual as a blogger may write it and it may get as much coverage. And that's the new phenomena where access to the internet and the web gives people a broad audience without the same traditional vetting or restraints.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things we like to do on New Books in Technology is for the authors to give kind of an elevator pitch. And that is, if someone were just to tune in randomly right now to the show, and they came to this point in the podcast, and they really need to know why they should, read your book, go out to, not go out to Amazon, but click on Amazon and purchase it, or go to the library and check it out, what would you tell them, elevator pitch?
Everybody exists in the new media world, and you need to understand how the blogger, how the media can disclose things about your personal life, what rights do you have, and what are the limits. It's not going to change. It's important to understand how that media works and the laws that protect individuals in this new storm of where everybody lives in a glass house. How do you protect that glass house?
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm just finished another book, a chapter in a book dealing with the National Security Administration and Snowden and some of those intrusions. And then I'm going to do some work on all of the wiretap issue and the actual data breaches that are occurring to corporations and individuals, and what are the legal remedies to those? And so dealing with the continual experience of intrusion from media, government, individuals, hackers.
And also, you are the director of the Center for Government Responsibility at the University of Florida, right?
Yes, and this is a place where we hope to foster careers in public service, explain why it's important to be engaged in government and in public policy issues like this one, like the environment, like the development of good public policy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And have you found privacy has gotten an even larger, to be an even larger issue in the development of public privacy policy?
Well, it has, and that's the public policy and the law is trying to catch up with technology, and even the newest cases about is it a search and seizure intrusion for an officer to seize a cell phone without a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it to the United States Supreme Court, and it's interesting to see that in that case, there's a recognition that seizing somebody's cell phone and looking through it is as intrusive or perhaps even more intrusive than going through somebody's house. So, yes, it's this interaction of technology and law is not going to get any easier.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is Privacy in the New Media Age, and the author is John L. Mills. And we thank you for being on New Books in Technology today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Okay, no problem. This has been New Books in Technology. Have a great week.